came from the person who wrote it, but how it got here is another story.
I know that story. Look.
Everyone loves getting mail, but have you ever stopped to wonder how your mail gets to your house? Millions and millions of letters arrive at the post office each and every day. There, the letters are sorted by postal clerks, who read the address on each letter and start it on its way to its final destination. The post office uses the most modern equipment available to help speed your letter to you. Once your letter arrives in your city, it's sorted by a postal carrier. That's right, the good old mailman. He puts your letter in his bag with all the other letters going to your street. Boy, oh boy, it's a hard job, but it sure looks like fun, doesn't it? Well, before you know it, your mailman's on your street with a cheery hello and the letter you've been waiting for. Everyone's happy when the mail gets to their house, and now you know how it got there.
That was really interesting, Reba. Now I know everything about the mail.
Thanks!
Well, since you brought up Kenneth Anger, I want to dip into the mailbag here, because this is something I had forwarded to you guys, and I know you actually tried. So, this was an email from a gentleman named Patrick, and it says, "Hey, I'm a new listener and reader of your blogs. Great stuff. Incidentally, I seem to have recently discovered a film album sync you might be interested in. I played The Beatles' Revolver, 1966, over Kenneth Anger's Lucifer Rising, finished in 70 but started in 66. I don't own the film and used YouTube, but I started Revolver at the very beginning of the film, 000. The screen will have a Puck Films logo. When George says, 'There's one for you, 19 for me,' the counter on the film should be at 19 seconds. The song goes all the way through the first scene, and the second scene starts right as track 2 starts, Eleanor Rigby. The third song, 'I'm Only Sleeping,' begins before the sleeping scene, but it gets there in plenty of time for it to significantly sync. There are three or four other wow moments as they continue on, but for the sake of brevity and self-discovery, I'll leave that to you guys. P.S. I tried it with Magical Mystery Tour because of all the visual crossovers, but it wasn't quite as syncy as Revolver. Not bad, though. Thanks, Patrick." Now, I sent this to you guys, and I know you actually tried it out. Can you tell me what happened?
I tried it. Maybe Bill should give his spiel first.
First of all, I thought it was brilliant to bring Kenneth Anger into this, because obviously Kenneth Anger was experimenting with syncing up pop music and film in an experimental way, you know, as he did with Rabbit's Moon. So the thought of taking it there is just brilliant on its own. The fact that it worked or didn't work wasn't going to bother me. I just liked the association of bringing Kenneth Anger into it. I thought that the album and the visuals for Lucifer Rising were pretty spectacular. I only got to watch it once. But, it allowed me to reimagine Lucifer Rising in a kind of a fresh perspective that I really, it's like I saw the film again for the first time. And it gave it a little bit more, I could see the sense of humor in it where I didn't before. It takes itself so fucking seriously, but to shake it up a little bit with Revolver, I got the sense of humor more out of it. I think that when one of the wow moments I'm sure he's talking about is when Yellow Submarine starts. It's a pretty spectacular bullseye. I would guess that you felt kind of the same way, Dave, that it was a pretty direct hit.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I watched it. I watched it the way that he recommended initially, and I watched it with a few different Beatles albums. Revolver is indeed the best that I could see, but I preferred the timing changed slightly so that there was a number of things, like when he wakes up, why not make it so when he wakes up that comes on, you know? So I set it so that it was right after the Magus logo disappears, so in between that and Anger's name appearing, And that way it says that's one for you, 19 for me. When, what is it, Bobby Busolini? I forget his name, the guy who did the music for it. So his name pops up when it says that, because that guy killed somebody. He stole the film. The film supposedly was like his big actual production that was like a full length feature. And the head actor in the movie, that boy, also did the music, but he did the music from prison after he killed somebody, after meeting up with Charles Manson. So he steals the film, meets up with Manson, kills somebody, and then Anger still has him do the soundtrack after the fact. And so the one for you, 19 for me makes it fucking extra eerie.
That is pretty intense, yeah.
Yeah, and then also, like, you know, the album is, I can't believe, like, the Beatles, man, like with Taxman at the beginning. So if you start it from that point too, when the actual Lucifer Rising, where it says Lucifer Rising and it rises up through the screen, when it says when I die, glue the pennies to my eyes so that the Taxman doesn't take them, you know, and so you can see the Taxman here is you know, like, it's, yeah, that's, I don't know how to say it, but there's a weird element to the tax man that he's basically, Hermes is the thief, right? So the tax man is essentially Hermes by extension. And so the symbolism in the film then becomes extra meaningful when you see the mercurial element being portrayed. Yeah, it's definitely one for meditation. That, like, that's I love, like, the inauguration of the Pleasure Dome was the same thing. I feel I need to experiment more, because I just got Scorpio Rising too, and I wanted to put them back to back and do some exploration there. I think that there could be something really interesting produced out of those three films with involving the Beatles, especially, like, with the Sergeant Pepper thing and the way that it resonates. Like, I don't know, it is pretty fucking trippy. And so, you know, you can see, like, you can appreciate everything involved, because obviously, like, Sergeant Pepper, you have obviously Crowley is the corner of the album, right? And if you mirror it, as was shown in the subliminal synchrosphere, you can make Crowley into the headstone. So cornerstone becomes the headstone. So the stone that the builders rejected becomes the keystone of the archway. So Crowley is literally the center of the archway when you do the mirroring effect and you tilt the album against itself, which is really, really neat. But then, you know, you can see that this is obviously Kenneth Anger is taking over the OTO, whereas, like, you know, Jack Parsons is taking over the OTO in Pasadena, California. But then who's the head of the OTO? And the fact that he's as obsessed with the clephotic side of the tree as he is, like, if you read his writing, it's like like you can see the interplay with him and the Beatles and what's being communicated to a degree that I personally don't feel is necessarily coincidental. Even if the album is coincidental, that it aligns in the way that it does, the fact that they're into what they're into, and playing albums backwards, they're playing on their own albums, and doing all kinds of interesting, like, you know, Thelemite activities, can't help but, like, be totally interesting. So anyways,
well, since you brought up the Tree of Life, there's this next sweater I want to read I think is directly tied into the Tree of Life. But we'll get there. This is from a gentleman named Neil. It says, "Hi, Alan. I've been listening to Always Record and 42 Minutes since your appearance on the Corbett Report, and I've caught the sync bug. I've been interested in symbolism for a while, but your discussions on archetypes and mythical themes in ancient cultures have changed the way I experience modern media. My 4-year-old son loves Disney's Cars, and I see parts of it every few days. When it was mentioned in an early episode of Always Record, Cars was described as a prison break movie. But there's a lot more to it than you'd think. Excuse me, I don't know why I'm having trouble reading this. But there's a lot more to it that I think you'd be interested in. I wouldn't say it's an important film that I need to tell everyone about, but as you're writing about King Kills, it should at least be on your radar. I'll just tell you the main themes and details that I've noticed, and I'll leave the sync work up to you. The film starts with the race commentators introducing the three favorites to win. They don't just name them, they name the archetypes, too. The reigning champion, the long-standing contender, and the rookie who shot to fame. Due to a three-way tie, the three favorites need to return for a deciding race. When the rookie loses his crew through his selfishness and gets trapped in a small town on Route 66, the stage is set for his personal journey. There are three main themes I think you'd be interested in, and I'll start with the one that first struck me. The name of the reigning champion character is The King, and it becomes clear near the end that he will retire after this last race. He's not dying, but his career is, and the other two are competing to take his place. Each car's sponsor relates to their character, and The King, who's becoming extinct, is sponsored by Dino Co. with a T-Rex and egg logo. The rookie's name is, of course, Lightning McQueen, and his trademark move is to reflect light off of one of the lightning bolts on his front wheel arches, dazzling the car next to him as he says, "Ka-chow." These bolts are very important to him, and at a pivotal moment, one of his bolts gets covered in tar. His promoter is Rust Ease, and during his transformation, he befriends the rustiest character in town, Mater. Although his main aim is in the beginning is to get sponsored by Dino Co., in the end, he chooses to stick with Rusty's. These two themes show the inner conflict between the lofty loneliness of stardom and the down-to-earth humility of friendship. The third theme is more subtle than the others, but it can be found in almost every part of the film. Success is always accompanied by symbols of flight. Lightning McQueen succeeds in the first race by bouncing off an upturned car's tires and soaring over the pileup. The main attraction of Dino Co. is the chance to fly in their helicopters. The Piston Cup is a goblet with wings, and McQueen's mentor, who holds the record of three consecutive Piston Cups, was known as the Hudson Hornet, no, not Hawk. He practices at his private track with a wing-shaped rock at its center, and he manages to glide round a corner where McQueen repeatedly falls off the edge and lands in the cacti. The symbol of the LA International Speedway is also a wing. The King has a huge spoiler which could symbolize wings, especially considering the only other car with this accessory is a street racer called Wingo. Yeah. On the opposite side of the coin is the longtime contender who fails to gain in popularity and Dino Co. sponsorship even after winning the Piston Cup is called Chick Hicks. Chick is sponsored by HTB, the Hostile Takeover Bank, and his trademark move is to nudge other cars and send them spinning off the track. When he nudges the King in the final race, it sends him flying spectacularly through the air before landing in a crumpled state, reminiscent of Doc Hudson in the crash that ended his career. This leads me to a question I've been pondering, which I'd love to hear your opinion on. The mentor saves the rookie and is reborn himself as the coach, while the rookie saves the King and ensures that he finishes the race and ends his career with honor. In a similar way, it could be said that he causes Doc Hudson's rebirth and allows him to die with honor. In Cars 2, there is only the Hudson Hornet Memorial Museum. Have you seen this kind of double King Kill elsewhere, and how does it fit in with the research for your book? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, and I'm looking forward to reading the book once it's released. The numerology in Cars might interest you too. At the start of the first race, McQueen psychs himself up with the words, "Speed, I am speed." Then he says, "One winner, 42 losers." As well as there being 43 cars in the race, the King's number is 43, and Chick's number is double that, 86, which according to IMDb is slang for thrown out, but is also the year in which the first Pixar short film was released. McQueen's number is 95, which doesn't relate to anything obvious in the film, but is the year Toy Story was released. There are many more references to people, places, and dates, both real and fictional, but hopefully I've given you enough to think about with the King Kill aspect alone. Good luck with the book launch, Neil.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, the idea of the, I mean, there's a character named Lightning McQueen, we have this idea of his lightning bolt getting covered in tar. When you're talking about the clephotic side of the tree of life.
Totally,
right? This idea of a T-Rex and egg logo, and then he's talking about the thing having wings on it. All I can think about is this sort of Orphic egg, the egg with the serpent or reptile wrapped around it.
Sure. And then the winged disc, obviously. That's, you know, the king.
And you were just talking about Mercury. And of course, the Caduceus is also serpents with wings around this center object.
So the lightning itself is a serpent, and that's important to remember.
Yes.
You could, either way. So one in descent and one in ascent, right? So, but first of all, it should be known that Pixar with Toy Story, there's no question between it being linked to The Shining as being a take on the uncanny, which is something I feel should, you know, eventually hopefully be common knowledge to some degree, you know, in certain circles, that's the meaning there. He's obsessed with Room 237 and The Shining, and appears throughout it. And obviously he's not one to just appreciate Kubrick simply as like he likes his movies or something. No, it's like, no, there's a depth of understanding with the one of those head Pixar guys. I don't know what his name is, but he's like the head director or whatever of those films. So there's definitely an argument for, you know, him doing something like that with a degree of intention. So it kind of moves beyond the you know, straight sync side.
Absolutely. And if we know that so someone in Pixar is familiar with, you know, is obviously not inspired by Kubrick, but also presumably then inspired by Freud, it's not hard to imagine that the next step after Freud and the uncanny is going into something a bit more esoteric.
Sure. Totally.
I mean, just this line of the email really jumps out to me. The rookie's name is, of course, Lightning McQueen, and his trademark move is to reflect light off of one of the lightning bolts on his front wheel arches, dazzling the car next to him as he says, ka-chow. These bolts are very important to him, and in a pivotal moment, one of his bolts gets covered in the car. Sorry. His promoter is Rusty's, and during his transformation, he befriends the rustiest character in town, Mater. Although his main aim at the beginning is to get sponsored by Dynaco, in the end, he chooses blah, blah, blah. It says, these two themes show the inner conflict between the lofty loneliness of stardom and the down-to-earth humility of friendship. To me, even in this email, I don't know if he realized what he was saying, the idea of down-to-earth humility of friendship being the moral. Well, here you have a lightning bolt, Lightning McQueen, befriending, I don't know if I'm pronouncing how they pronounce it in the movie, but the character's name is Mater. Well, what is that but matter, right? The idea of the lightning bolt is taking spirit into matter. So the down-to-earth humility of friendship is literally the lightning bolt coming down into matter. You also have the idea of it could be Mater and something maternal. We can take all of these things being symbolized in Malkuth, but pretty explicitly, a lightning into matter.
Totally. You could relate this as race cars to the race horses in The Killing, and remember that the one of the most famous race horses who ever lived was named Red Rum.
Oh shit!
Red Rum racehorse. I'll look it up real quick.
So I think it's interesting that the Lightning McQueen's number is 95. Now, if it was 93. We'd know. But that's pretty damn close. So, I'm trying to figure out if there's something sort of in, I don't know. This is the, I mean, I'd have to kind of watch the movie, but I'm almost, it's not, doesn't seem off to me that there could be some sort of cipher in there. If Lightning McQueen's number is 95, and we know that he's really symbolizing 93, is there some sort of cipher of a, you know, minus 2 or something in the car numbers? He says the king's number is 43. minus that would be 41. Minus two would make it 41. It doesn't jump out at me, except for, of course, being like, and this is a stretch, but a play on, you know, the 14 pieces of Osiris or something. Chick's number is double that, 86. Minus two would be 84, which I guess, you know, we could see as the sort of the, you know, something with 1984 or something like that. I don't know. I'm just sort of throwing that out there if that does anything for you guys. But that was something when I'm thinking of this Lightning character with number 95, it seems pretty damn close to 93 for me.
Well, Red Rum died in 1995. I don't know what that means.
How about the 42 losers? One winner, 42 losers.
Yeah.
That's to be... there's something kind of snarky about that comment, right? Grouping all the losers into 42, that the winner is outside of 42.
Absolutely.
Everyone else in the rainbow, which is the seven lower spheroid, right?
Well, yeah. And you realize that, you know, it's funny because if you bring that up, depending on if any of this is intentional and where their inspiration comes from, they don't have to be Jake Kotze synchromystics where they associate 42 with something positive. Crowley said 42 was essentially the fingerprint of the demiurge.
Totally. Because of that, I wonder. That's, wow, okay.
So it's basically like, fuck the 42. I want to be apart from that. I want to fly above it, especially when he's saying all this stuff about flight and ascending above things. Is like, 42 is for losers. I'm raising myself above it.
Hmm. That's pretty heavy.
Yeah. And especially if the king's number... So he says, there's 43... That means there's 43 cars in the race, and the king's number is 43, implying that the king is that one winner above the 42, right?
Right, well, the last shall be first, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. And that's for the king of kings. Huh. Interesting.
Wasn't Steve Jobs, wasn't Pixar his project?
I don't know.
When he left Apple, he went and started up a digital film company, and I'm pretty sure it was Pixar.
Hmm.
Pixar is attached with Disney, right?
Correct, yes. They originally, Disney was like their distributor, and then they kind of got like partially bought out, and now I think they've freed themselves. I think they've freed themselves for some creative control again.
So if anyone was beyond the 42 saying fuck the 42, it was Steve Jobs.
Or if you can get yourself out of the tentacles of Disney.
Right. Right. Which is, people point out, I don't know how, you know, how much it's intentional, but the 666 and Disney's signature, you've seen that before, probably.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's funny because I was just thinking this idea that the Lightning McQueen gets trapped in a small town on Route 66, and 66 is also often thought as a reference to the Kleepo.
Right.
So, you know, you're getting tar on your lightning bolt, you're getting trapped in the 66. And so it's funny, as I'm thinking this, you say Disney 666.
Right. I just wanted to mention, I had mentioned it to you in a comment, and you may have been aware of this. I don't know. You didn't, comment back, but, so I was studying some commentary the other day, with my teacher, and we came across, a direct reference to Joaquin and Boaz, which is very rare. To go into in the Zohar commentary. My teacher is like this never comes up, but it's here in this paragraph, so let's go into it. And so he didn't actually even realize what it meant, what Joaquin and Boaz meant, because he is aware of them. It's like his father was a Mason, you know, and he's seen the pillars a lot, you know, but he wasn't aware of what the word Joaquin and Boaz actually meant. And so we looked it up, and it is actually to be established in strength. And the strength that's being referred to is Boaz. Like, it's the bait is with. So it's with strength is literally what that's taken as. And so I don't know if Kotze's aware of that, but I mean, for the whole argument, like with the Wiz, with the two towers and all of that, like, and then the fact that you have Oz on the sphere that was between them, like, and then looking at that as the Holy of Holies, and these are the pillars of Solomon's temple, which are, you know, like that the pillars of Solomon's temple literally in the Torah, because this is in the Torah where they're called Yachin and Boaz, literally means to be established in Oz. Isn't that trippy? I don't know.
That's huge. That's definitely huge.
Yeah, I was like, wow. Well, and like, and so it's funny because if you actually look up on Wikipedia, Yachin and Boaz, which has its own page, it doesn't actually say that. It says what Yachin means, but then it glosses, it skips over the definition of Boaz.
So what does it say? Yachin means like establishment or?
To form, to like formulate.
Okay.
To be, you know, formed in strength, to be established in strength, same thing. But yeah, no, it's just, I found that really interesting. And so you can see, you know, the, obviously, but it would be 79 because you add bait to it, but still, I mean, it's trippy.
Oh my God, as I'm just thinking with this, there's a, this is kind of a weird thing, but, all right. And James Shelby Downard makes this comment comparing Marilyn Monroe to Set's wife. And he says because she manipulates ostrich feather boa. Yeah, I guess it's like this reasoning why. And it's actually a very solid correlation. But anyway, I just I'm sitting here looking at this, and instead of an, if you make that instead of an H, you make it a K, it's like Jack in Boa, like the idea of like Jack being a reference to John F. Kennedy in, this is like really kind of silly that I shouldn't even say this out loud, but this is where my mind just went. Can you picture what I'm saying?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, the thing that comes to my mind is that John Kennedy is JK, which could also be just kidding.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Killing joke, right? Sorry.
JFK. Just fucking kidding, man. All right. Moving along. This is one from April 17th, and I assume this was meant for one of you guys. It says, ha. Saw your comment beneath my Dangerous Minds White Album Manson piece and am listening to your podcasts as I write. Really interesting. You guys are on the vanguard, man. Thomas. Did one of you reach out to some?
Yeah, there was an article at Dangerous Minds about the coincidences between Rosemary's Baby and the White Album. And I just kind of wrote a comment, why don't you just combine the two literally, and I threw a link to the show, the episode, in the comment section. So that's cool that he got to it.
Wow, that's really cool.
Said no schizo.
Yeah.
That's a good article. I really. That's rad.
Yeah, no, you know, I think that the comment section is a pretty great avenue for exposure, especially if, you know, think about in Facebook how sometimes in a thread, the best way to establish your point is just to write a link to a blog post, right? It's just sort of saying, hey, I talk about all this in detail right here. Boom.
Hey, except you'll kick off the Secret Sun.
Yeah. But if you can say, hey, we go into a little bit more detail on this. Here's 3.5 hours.
Yeah, just a little more detail.
Right.
But I'm glad that, I mean, it was such a bullseye. Like, it was a no-brainer. It was like, it wasn't like self-promotion and it wasn't like.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, hey.
We got there first. It was just sort of like, holy shit, you're right where we're at. Check it out. And so that kind of. That respect shown in that email, that's nice. That's good to hear.
Here's one from a gentleman named Norman Ball. It's not much of a – this is another – This is kind of what you're talking about right here. So the gentleman says, "Hi, Alan. I wanted to alert you to my Jungian Bowie blog, Red Book, Red Sail. I'm going through your various materials at the moment." And his website is redbookredsail.wordpress.com. And he says, "Take care, Norm Ball." I actually, when he sent this to me back in April, I did look this over. It looks awesome, but I'm just so overwhelmed that I didn't get a chance to dive into it. But I hope anyone interested in Carl Jung and David Bowie will take a look. I should forward this to Jason.
You should put a link to it when we put this recording up. It's awesome.
Oh. People pay attention because I'm not doing links. I'm just trying to find make sense of my inbox. I'm kind of trying to go through these. Let's see. Okay. Which ones are here's this was from our conversation with Jake Kotze. "Hey, Alan, just a couple things that caught my attention during your most recent interview with Jake. You guys dug into the word meme, and I find it funny that such a word was actually coined by the militant atheistic materialist Richard Dawkins. I'm pretty sure he would be horrified by it being used in sync circles, and that brings me a bit of joy." Also, you said that you noticed that the new Spider-Man was like They Live with a David Icke-like spin. Did you know that the original storyline They Live was based on is from a short story called 8 O'Clock in the Morning, written by Ray Faraday Nelson? He was a close friend of both Philip Dick and L. Ron Hubbard. In that short story, the aliens are not zombies, but rather reptilians. Just thought you'd find that interesting."
That's excellent.
Totally.
This is also a comment from the Jake Kotze episode. "An interesting episode as usual. I like Jake's point of view, even though I think it's quite radical. If I understand rightly, he's saying everything is the doing of one's own essence, which seems in a sense a logical inference from the notion that everything is an interconnected whole, which is what sync seems to imply. I have noticed, however, that often people seem to accuse or dismiss this point of view as being merely solipsism. I would have loved the conversation to have gone more into the whole question of solipsism, and if everything is seen as the doing of one's own essence, how that translates into the perception of one's day-to-day life." This is from a woman named Angela.
Nice.
Anyone want to comment on Kotzean solipsism?
I've been kind of going over Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle again recently.
Perfect.
Perfect.
And what a frightening, frightening book that is. But, you know, the whole essence of The Man in the High Castle, his role in creating The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, God, the hangover is really going to prevent me from tackling this, but I think that notion of solipsism is addressed perfectly with that character, because Philip K. Dick doesn't put any moral judgment on it, and he doesn't tell you how to feel about it. He just brings you there, you know, into the world of the man in the high castle. And, you know, there's a very real world out in the streets where people look to a book like The Grasshopper Lies Heavy just to get through each day. Or you could actually be the man in the high castle, be the man behind the pen, you know, creating the words on the page. And, you know, in essence, the world of The Grasshopper Lies Heavy is the world that he lives in his castle, right? He's, he has written history back to where he feels comfortable with it. Do you guys know the book?
Yeah, I've actually I've been thinking about it a lot the last few weeks also, because when I did Anthony Peake's show, I was talking to him about Philip K. Dick and the I Ching, and it was just such a rushed interview. It's like trying to compress everything into an hour, and I wanted to talk to him basically about the idea of that was the book he wrote using the I Ching as the structuring mechanism, yes?
Yes, that's correct.
So I wanted to talk to about the idea of how one can, you know, when we say, is it sync? Is it intentional? Is it this gray area in between? This is someone utilizing a one of these, I'm just going to use a broad term, you know, one of these esoteric schools of thought. You know, I'm going to lump I Ching in there with it, with, you know, things like Tarot and Kabbalah, et cetera, et cetera. Using one of these systems to directly structure your artwork. So that's an intentional use, but it also is an opening the door to synchronicity by using it randomly, essentially. I just think it's a really interesting little correlation there of what he tried to do. And I've also heard Philip K. Dick say he felt like that was sort of a failed experiment because it didn't give him a sort of solid ending. But that's because, and to me that's like a no-brainer, is that's of course you wouldn't get a solid ending, because the whole point of the I Ching is to show you that things never end, they keep changing. So you'll never have a solid ending.
Right. Or that the I Ching is a book of changes, and every shift is a different parallel universe, right? So the whole idea in that book is that if he's going to write about the I Ching in the book, the I Ching is the same wherever it is, if it's on a page of fiction or if it's in your daily life. So wherever the I Ching is, it functions in the exact same way. So that when these characters are utilizing the I Ching in his fiction, he actually has to activate the I Ching for them. So he didn't know where that book was going to end up, because it had to pass through the I Ching itself. So I'm imagining that he found an ending that he could live with. It probably wasn't the most exciting ending of possible endings, but he's like, I can live with that ending, because there are other endings this could have gone to that I might have not made it out of my house for the rest of my life. Because it was working in concert so closely. And he goes into detail later on about how he always wanted to write a sequel to that book, but he was unable to because he couldn't put himself back in that world. And that is a very that's that spooky shit that good writing should elicit in your mind at times, right? I think we've gone over the conversation many times here and in other places of the artist, the creator, writing something and then it manifests itself later down the road. I think Grant Morrison is a perfect example of that. And really, Philip K. Dick is a perfect example of that, because a lot of the experiences he went through later in life, they're all there in his early novels. I mean, everything that he actually experiences are in the novels. I'm hoping that that's where Anthony Peake takes his latest novel, is that notion. Did you get a sense of that's where Anthony Peake was kind of going? Or?
Well, I don't know what – I mean, he was commissioned to write a biography. So his Philip K. Dick book is essentially a biography, but he went through, you know, what was I'm sure was really cool is it gave him access to a lot of, you know, notes, original writings, interviews with – he got to speak to Tessa Dick and, you know, different people go through a lot of his letters and so on. So I as far as what style it's going to be written in, I assume it's going to be a pretty – straightforward biography, and at the same time I'm sure it's going to give him some sort of very interesting insight
it's not like he put a shitload of research and effort into this one.
I would think so. And at the same time I can't figure out how the hell he he stays so damn productive. You know, he's, you know, to do like four books at a time or something, and I'm sorry, I made like a folder for in my email for things, but then I started utilizing it for other things, so now I'm trying to go through this stuff. Here's one. Hey guys, just finished listening to Droidify on 42 Minutes, and it was mentioned that there should be a synchromistic Tumblr. Good news, there already is one, and it's brilliantly done. The blog name is thesearenotmymemories.tumblr.com. Love the shows. Can't wait to hear more. Take care.
Cool. I got one I'd like to mention.
Yeah, please.
That you're talking about the I Ching, and so this guy's message brought that up for me. I get on my my artist page, my MK Ultrasound page, I sometimes get messages about Always Record. That's how I think John Sousa may have initially found me. So anyways, in the last Always Record 49 at 1 hour and 26 minutes in, you talk about Jupiter / Prometheus. It made me remember this. And so he has this article that's really kind of fun about Prometheus goes
I know that guy sent me that message too. That's an awesome connection.
Totally. And so he says Prometheus goes 35 light years into space, but Charlize Theron gaffes, we're a 500 million miles from Earth, which is just past Jupiter. And so there's kind of a interesting thing going on that it's supposed to be a mistake. And they're like, oh, you know, but that's a pretty fucking big mistake. You know, like, I don't know with a film that elaborate if they would have just slipped that up there. And the fact that it's just past Jupiter feels significant to me. And, mega Charlize Theron saying it also feels significant.
I went back and forth with that guy a little bit, and he said, what you see on the screen is a planet that looks like Saturn. Now, in 2010, the year we make contact, of course, Saturn or Jupiter, whatever, becomes the second sun known as Lucifer. So to have Charlize Megatherion, the 666 beast or sun, right? The whole point of Megatherion was that it added up to 666. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Completely, yeah.
Yeah, no, so to be the second sun, Lucifer, and to be the beast and the 666, which is the sun square, is highly, highly resonant.
I see that the ship is Prometheus, and Prometheus is sacrificing himself for humanity in the same way that Lucifer did.
It's almost the same archetype, right? It's the idea of, you know, sacrificing yourself to bring light or knowledge or some sort of renegade spirit to humanity. Prometheus, you know, wants to bring fire to man, and Zeus basically says, you know, no, they won't be as subservient. They'll think themselves on. In what I use in. Look at All the Happy Creatures is an adaptation from a book called, I want to say the author's name is Evelyn Hoops. Regardless, they literally say, man will think themselves on par with the gods. Zeus's complaint is, man will think himself an equal of the gods if he has fire. Well, what is the complaint of Lucifer is that he's, you know, this idea of being his own god, or, you know, challenging gods. Unique authority or something like that. So to me, it's very, very, very much the same story or same archetype.
The serpent who says, I can make you like the gods.
Yes.
Place. And then this also reminds me of Mystery Babylon, where you have, you know, the people want to make themselves famous. Literally, they want to make a name for themselves. That's a rationale for building the tower. And when they build the tower, it says, look, now that they've done this, they can do anything. So what is God, who is plural in this case, does is comes down, the Elohim comes down and confounds their language. Now, I had a thing happen the other day where I was at a grocery store, And this guy notices that I'm wearing a close friend of mine gave me a gold Metropolis necklace. It's literally the Gollum from Metropolis. It's the Maria's replacement. And I'm wearing that with a Star Wars shirt that has C-3PO on it. And I know that there's this connection between C-3PO. C-3PO is obviously modeled after this character from Metropolis. But he goes to me, he goes, oh, that's funny, you know, that he's modeled. And that for some reason, somebody else saying this to me got me to, like, reflect on it as I was walking out. Like, and then I was like, wait a minute. He's a fucking protocol droid. This is the whole thing is that the robot is there for the perfection of Babylon and ends up destroying Babylon in the story of Metropolis, right? This is all about the Tower of Babel, and that's the city, right? And so they destroy themselves by following this golem. And so I realized that C-3PO being a protocol droid of the Rebel Alliance is that's too much. Like, you have them rebelling against the Empire in Metropolis and end up destroying their own houses. And so you have, what is C-3PO but the failsafe of the rebels? Because they're like, okay, worst case scenario, we get our language confound, like what happened last time in the story. You know, like those who don't know.
And he's there to translate for them.
So they can't fuck up because they got a robot to take care of it. And who is the robot but Maria's replacement? It's just too perfect.
That's really good.
Yeah,
I've often thought. I mean, the idea of the, you know, obviously C3 is a 33.
Mm-hmm.
I've often tried to consider what the significance of that may or may not be. Why he would be that? But if he's what you just said, sort of. In a weird sort of way, at least in a sync way, answers that question for me, because if he's the failsafe, and bye baby, have a great day. If he's the failsafe of the fallen tower, right? 33 is also a reference to Kundalini, because it's the 33 segments of your spine. So the idea of if you're building the tower, and if it collapses, he's there to tell you what he's there to translate for you. He is the 33. Mm-hmm. He in his weird sort of sense, he is the completed tower.
Totally. Exactly. And so the character itself is completely, that's like the Adam being the tree.
Yeah.
It's the same. So you have that he's the embodiment of what the tower represents.
And it's funny because C-3PO, you know, I've made this connection of, like, is, you know, I guess I take everything to an Egyptian angle, but, you know, C-3PO, at some point in the, I guess, episode 6, he gets dismembered, right, when he gets blasted apart and they have to put him back together. And I, of course, think of Osiris, but then he is in the myth, Osiris's new phallus is a golden phallus, and C-3PO, not even to be like, this is kind of a joke, but I mean this very seriously, C-3PO is kind of a dick. Like, he's, you know, so here he is this golden phallus being put back together, and sort of there, which would be the which would signal the Aeon of Horus or the Millennium Falcon, right? So I've thought about that, but of course, Jason and I have had the conversation that Darth Vader is much more of the Osiris figure. He's the black god, the dark god who gets pieces of him cut off. But now this all comes full circle when we see in Episode 1 that C-3PO is actually built by Darth Vader.
Right, right. He's also he's the gold and he's the black. You have the two sides of the coin.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
More machine now than man. It's like he's been taken over by the Clefotic.
Yet you notice in Episode 1 he doesn't have he doesn't have the gold. What you see is more silver and red, which you would go your alchemical stages would be black, white, I guess black, white, yellow, red. But there's this sort of hint of that in there when you see the silver plating and the red wiring.
Totally. Huh. Well. Huh. Actually, I got to meet Anthony Daniels at one point. My sister got me tickets to something in San Francisco called An Evening at the Cantina, where they actually had all the original Star Wars outfits and people wearing the Star Wars outfits and like all the models and everything set up. And he was talking to this group of people, and it was totally like he was C-3PO. Like the attitude that C-3PO has in the story, attitude that Anthony Daniels had, it was really weird. But I was going to make a little joke that his initials are AD, so you could see him as After Descendant. So he literally is the you know, by extension, the Millennium Falcon. It's another Millennium. Anyways.
You guys ever see the resemblance of Crowley to when Vader takes off the mask?
Yeah, I have.
Absolutely, yeah.
Totally. I don't know if that's intentional.
Could just be a coincidence.
He does look like him, especially he's all crusty. He looks like a dead Crowley. He looks like Crowley if you dug him up or something, you know.
Absolutely. And Crowley totally would dig that Vader suit, man. He would fucking love that.
Totally. I really like the idea of Vader as the Aught, and so that he's a placeholder for the Empire to establish itself, and the Empire is literally Malkuth, but it's not really Malkuth, it's the Scarlet Woman, and so he becomes, you know, Metatron, obviously, but he's this, like, he's just, his whole thing is, like, breaking apart. He's having to hold the Force. He's the dark side of the Force, right? So he's the Force holding the vectors from falling into place, and it weighs on him, right? And so that's the whole deal there. I don't know. I trip out about it.
Wow, that's all. I haven't thought of it that way.
And so he's also like Oz in the sense that he has strength, but his strength is limited as he's basically drawing upon the Kleepot in order to maintain the Empire's reign, you know. And then the Emperor himself it's like for him to be this, like, I don't know, this dark sorcerer, like, I don't know, it's all so perfect Kabbalistically. I love it.
Do you think that with the three prequels that Lucas made, and now that they're going to go forward with three more big budget Hollywood Star Wars releases, that this is just damaging and diluting the power of those first original three films?
I yesterday I posted to my friend a reference to the power glove, because it's Lucas who shows Savage the power glove. Do you know what I'm talking about? He goes, I love the power glove. It's bad. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay, I just like it, looking at it like the Wizard of Oz being Vader, and that it's actually like Lucas has the power glove, and it's like, I don't know.
Well, I had read years ago that, I mean, I'm not a huge Star Wars fan, so I'm sure someone could correct me on this, but I remember reading years ago something to the effect of that Lucas said the reason he would never wanted to do Episodes 7, 8, and 9, or decided not to, was because it would take away from the ending of showing the Empire falling, that he felt like it was a really solid ending. But that was before the prequels were made. And then the prequels, you know, you could argue why he did that. You know, was it, you know, wanted to do money, or did he have this realization? I've come to realize, or I think come to realize, that there was actually a very intelligent play on Lucas's part, which shows that by doing the prequels after and showing the rise of the Empire, it shows the true cyclical nature. So maybe a young, idealistic Lucas said, no, I want to end it with the Empire being destroyed. That's the solid ending, and I want to leave it there. And then as he gets older, realizes, there is no end. The Empire never ended. So you show the cyclical format of it, of showing it rise, showing you see the rise of the Empire in the first three prequels. Then you see the rise of the Rebels in the next three movies. At the same time, mirroring the Rebels with the sort of Empire. particularly by the scene at the end of Star Wars A New Hope, which was based on a Nazi propaganda film. So you have this idea of that the rebels are inherently aspects of the Empire.
Oh, sure. I think he knew it. I knew it to begin with, that it was all, you know, to some high degree in his awareness what he was playing with, only because THX 1138.
Right.
For THX, I don't know if I would feel that way, but I feel like he knew what he was trying to communicate, and that to bring up hope and to, you know, bring it down and to do what he did. But
part of me feels go ahead, man.
So, okay, I'll try and say this as quickly as possible. So, in the subliminal synchrosphere, he actually posts a page from a book from the head sound man of A New Hope, who was the guy who came up with how to do THX sound. In other words, he's a sound bigwig, right? In a page in his book talking about his experience with Lucas, he actually states that Lucas had adepts, quote-unquote adepts, standing around the film cameras, basically projecting their, you know, meditation will into the film in order to imbue it with a magical energy, I guess. I don't know how to say it, but I don't remember how he said it exactly, but something along those lines. And he said he had seen this a number of times in recording studios with musicians, where they'd have these guys that are there just to project energy. Kind of weird, but the fact that this isn't like a book about that, it's just a book about this guy's experience as a sound man, and yet he drops that in there, I don't know. Kind of interesting.
I mean, that's huge. I mean, I feel like one of the I've mentioned this a number of times, but I feel like one of the a huge missing piece here is one sentence of Chris Meyer's chapter for Sync Book 1. I've read this before. Just give me 1 second. I'll find it again. He says, spiritualist William Crookes had invented the Crookes tube after scrying in a black mirror as a way to communicate with spirits. Now, besides the Crookes tube leading to the discovery of electrons and later X-rays, it was used to invent the original standard TV. Spiritualist John Logie Baird, born 1888, who invented the television itself, had said in his own book that he was in contact with the spirit of Thomas Edison. So the idea of these things receiving spirits, and now you're saying, well, why not put your own spirit in it? Like, it is a, you know, we call this media or medium. What is, you know, someone who contacts spirits is known as a medium. So we have this, that the media itself is in a weird sort of way a medium for contacting spirits. And it, to me, it seems like the next natural step is to see if you can put your own spirit into it.
Heavy magics, bro.
Yeah.
Gotta get out the posse of adepts.
It's
how do you go out and recruit adepts to chant and meditate for you?
Yeah. Hey, I'm making a film and I need someone to Bill, that's like, our missing calling. Oh my god. This is how we're gonna make money. We're not gonna do Kickstarter. We're not gonna do Indiegogo. We're just going to get movie studios to hire us to project our will into movies.
Dude, totally. I'd hire us. Or if we do a Kickstarter, you know, for that like $1,400 donation, we'll show up at your studio or whatever, and we'll lay down some good vibes.
I'm down. That sounds like a great.
Do you think we could lay down vibes through Skype?
well, we're laying down vibes all the time. I think the idea of them bringing in these adepts is because they're literally, like, you know, in the mystery schools with titles and stuff. You know, you need to go through some before you get hired in Hollywood. You know, you got to have some card that says you have some order on the deal.
Well, we're building a resume here on Always Record. One day I'm going to show up. Here's my business card. Alan, we'll chant for food.
I want to know if they were, like, wearing, like, Jedi robes.
Right?
I'm just visualizing the Jawas. You know, like the Neil Young concert?
See, this is why I wouldn't get hired, because what I'm envisioning is here's a multi-million-dollar movie production that's going to be seen by a lot of people, and you're hiring me to project will into it. I'm going to project my own fucking will into it.
Right.
You know, it's like, what are they projecting? Like, I want Star Wars to be successful. Or are they projecting, like, you know, ooh, this true mysticism to the Force and the Jedi? Or is the guy sitting there projecting, I hope this movie does well enough that I can buy a Lamborghini? You know, like, what is the guy thinking?
I don't know.
Or maybe, you know, Lucas was asking some pretty regular people to put a lot of trust in him, making what, I'm sure on the surface during the filming of it, a lot of those actors thought, what the fuck am I doing on this set? There's a talking grizzly bear. There's, you know, like on the surface before the editing and the Hollywood magic, I mean, Harrison Ford must have been like, how the fuck did I get myself into this? This is insane.
Yeah, that's what they, yeah, I've seen those interviews. They're funny as hell. Because they didn't even know. They didn't think it was going to be a success. They thought that they were making just like a shitty sci-fi movie. And they, so and they
some sort of high-level sense of humor to bring in those meditating adepts to kind of break the ice or I don't know. It could have been a trick to kind of get everybody in the right mood to just say, well, we're here. We've got the money. Might as well buy into it.
Yeah, because maybe, you know, on the first few weeks of shooting, everyone's like, I'm sorry, I can't take this man in the grizzly bear costume seriously. And then you go, you know, no, man, this is a serious film. Like, you got to treat that grizzly bear like it's a...
You love Chewbacca.
Exactly.
You love Chewbacca.
And
someone got out of my way was totally ad-libbed, by the way. That wasn't in the script.
What was?
Could someone get this walking carpet out of my way?
Oh,
that's good.
I didn't realize they were filming at that moment. No, that was
how difficult it would be to be Harrison Ford, and the first time you have to say with intensity, like, "Come here, Chewie!" Like, I'm sure to be able to not laugh and say that with a straight face. I mean, I imagine that's why you get paid the big bucks. But do you think Harrison Ford just steps right into the Han Solo like he just delivers? Or he's got to warm up to Chewie. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure the money helps and the, hey, we're gonna make you a sex figure. You know, you'll be wanted by women all over the world for the next 30 years. I'm sure that doesn't hurt. You know, I think it's got to be harder for Mark Hamill where you say, hey, we're going to portray you as this really dumb, annoying kid. Or you have to wear this gold robot costume and talk like a moron. I think, hey, we need you to be the sexy guy, and all you have to do is, you know, pat your hairy friend on the back a few times. I think that's an easy enough sell.
Hmm.
Well, I mean, he was also throwing his career kind of on the line. I mean, all his success came post Star Wars. I imagine you just sort of go all in with a project like that, just sort of like a crossroads in your career.
I was talking to, so I actually just did some narration for Will Morgan and Andras Jones are making another film, and they asked me if I would do some narration for it. And it was funny because I was talking to Andras about this stuff, and they give me the script, and he says to me, it was his sort of piece of advice was this one line. He's like, well, it's a bad line. He's like, and as an actor, the only way to handle a really bad line is to go all in and oversell it. And I was like, is that really good advice or is that really bad advice? Is it like, because that's how you end up with, you know, some of the really like gut wrenching. Oh my God, I can't believe why is, you know, I'm trying to think of a good example, but like, why is someone, you know, you could, is it, you know, you're going for like Stella and what you really get is some, you know, Plan 9 from outer space weird, you know, weirdness. I don't know if I'm making myself clear. I don't think my words aren't with me today, but I think you get what I'm saying is the idea of like, you know, when you say as far as going all in, maybe it's like, even if it is bad, you bring yourself to it. You know, it's like, well, if you think you're a good actor, then that's it. You know, it's like, I can make this the best. I'm going to be the best Han Solo I can be, regardless if the movie itself sucks.
Well, they didn't know what they were making. And when they went to see it in the theater, when it first was released, they couldn't believe that that was the movie that they were a part of. They're like, well, that's me there, but you couldn't see the, you had to have a vision of what it is that you're doing from the get-go. And it's pretty incredible that it came together in the way that it did. That's actually kind of nuts. You know?
Yeah. I had read a review with the, an interview with, what's the guy in episode one who plays, Qui-Gon, Liam Neeson, I think.
Zeus.
Yeah. He said that, like, he was like, this is not, and it was funny because I remember even thinking at the time that I read the interview, it was like, he says, this isn't a movie for actors. He's like, you basically show up, and you're like on this blue screen, and you just talk to something, and then it's like, they're like, we're just going to do everything else afterwards. And I was thinking, no, you moron. That is the movie for actors, because not just anyone can go and stand in front of a blue screen and go, hey, Jar Jar, and then you go like, all right, you'll make that look good. But the reason that the first three movies were so strong is because those people really did act.
Right.
They convinced you that they were that carpet or that grizzly bear was real and that you should love it as much as they do.
Totally.
Do you know what I'm saying? So it's like, I was saying, this is a movie for the only way, you know, this is we've done this horrible thing where our special effects have gotten to such a point where you can have Shea LaBeouf standing in front of a blue screen going, hey, my robot friend, come, let's go fight bad guys or something. And you don't, and everyone's like, it'll just look really cool. But the magic of Star Wars, aside from all these other things that we've talked about, you know, maybe Transformers needs to have some adept putting the spirit of Metatron into the actual movie or something. But I think beyond that, it's like you need an actual actor. You know, you need someone who can really sell it. And the going even to the other side of the coin from Star Wars to Star Trek. I mean, like take a guy like the Captain Picard guy.
William Shatner? No, that's I forget his name.
Well,
yeah.
William Shatner is the guy who oversells the bad lines. Thank you. See, that's what I was afraid of when Andros gave me that advice. But no, I'm thinking of the guy from Next Generation, Picard. He plays Professor X. you know.
God damn, I'm trying. I can't think of it.
Anyway, that guy. You know, that guy is like a Shakespearean actor. You know, the guy who plays opposite him in X-Men, the guy who played Gandalf and Magneto, Ian McKellen, his name I actually can remember. Oh, Patrick Stewart, that's his name. You know, Ian McKellen, you know, these guys are like legit actors who can bring something to it. So you're convinced not just by the special effects that, oh, this guy is a flying man who manipulates metal, or he's reading my mind, but, you know, or that he's the captain of a spaceship, but you're actually bringing that acting to it. So when I see you talking to some guy with like, you know, a coat hanger on his forehead and, you know, some cheesy space alien, I'm not really thinking, wow, that's a super cheesy space alien. You're selling it to me. I'm convinced that that's some sort of other creature that you're talking to.
You know, Ewan McGregor, who's Obi-Wan in episode one, that was the first movie that he did that was a Hollywood movie. And he actually, I remember, after he did Trainspotting, he actually swore that he would never do a Hollywood movie because he loved the independent scene so much. And then when they interviewed him about that, I remember he was just like, well, Star Wars.
Right.
He's agreeing to. So you fell out big time, you know.
Exactly.
Go all in.